In some ways, our book is actually about the low-hanging fruit. Our book is about, we got 10 years to halve emissions. Actually, there's a big chunk of emissions we can't, we know we have the technology. We actually know the social change, institutional change, and legislative change needed to do it. So let's do it. There's absolutely no excuse to not do it.
Corinne Sauers and Eric Lonergan are my guests on this episode of Inside Ideas, brought to you by 1.5 Media and Innovators Magazine, sponsored by the Alohas Regenerative Foundation. Corinne started her career at the UN working on climate change. She has been advising global business and governments on climate and sustainability for more than a decade. She is co-founder of the not-for-profit More United. Eric is a policy economist and an author with more than 20 years experience in financial markets. He is co-author with Mark Blythe of the international bestseller, Angrynomics. Agenda 2020 is the publishing house for that. He has written extensively on innovations and monetary policy and frequently contributes to the Financial Times. We are here today to talk about this hot off the press flaming book, Supercharge Me. It's a wonderful book. I've read it three times, physical copy once, and twice on Kindle Audible version. So Charge Me is a fast-paced, clearly written manual on how to accelerate the green transition. It's really this dialogue between Eric and Corinne who really go back and forth discussing and getting into the depth and substance things, moving away from more academic or just discussion, getting into the depth of action. What can we do, policy, frameworks, and accelerate the response in this decade of time that we have left to reach the Paris Agreement and the Sustainable Development Goals? They introduce a concept of supercharging a new framework for accelerating our response to this climate change that we're facing, this climate crisis. Through a series of high-impact policy hacks, Supercharge Me will embolden activists, reinvigorate the disheartened, and reframe the climate crisis as an opportunity. So I'm so excited to have you both here on the show and on the podcast. Welcome. How are you?
Thanks, Mark.
Very well.
Yeah, really good. And very, very excited to be on the podcast. Really looking forward to it.
I'm glad to have you here, and I'm glad we could coordinate it. And it's really timely around your release and kind of promotion and going into things. Is this one of the first podcasts you've done on the book so far?
We did do a live podcast for an Irish audience, which was quite the experience. It was a Saturday night over many beers.
It was absolute chaos, but we did our best.
Well, that's great. That's fabulous. At least it was a good environment, and chaos is sometimes good. So I'm big on chaos theory. I want to jump right in to the first question. So Supercharge Me can be taken in a bunch of different ways. And I really want to hear it straight from you guys. Does it mean supercharge me with more taxes and policies? Does it mean supercharge me with tools and empowerment to address all the problems we're facing? Or is it more a systemic supercharge? Can you kind of go into to how the title came about?
Sure. So it's really hopefully all of those, and you'll be aware of the structure. So we're big believers that the idea of supercharging is about actions rather than targets. So everybody now has targets. All of our nations have targets pretty much, and companies are coming up with targets. But we're really interested in what we're actually going to do. And so we think there's a consensus that we're not moving fast enough. So the subtitle of the book is Net Zero Faster. So we want to supercharge the system so that we start to reduce emissions much more rapidly. But the way we break it down is we look at the individual, we look at companies, we look at financial markets, we look at nations, and then we look at the world. And we're trying to give you a policy hack or a framework at each one of those levels to supercharge, i.e. to have big impact, and to make really rapid change.
Yeah, and
Corinne?
I was just going to build on that actions, not targets idea because it's come to me a lot over the last 7, 8 weeks whilst we've been witnessing, the terrible Ukraine war. We were inspired on this actions, not targets piece by an essay written by Thomas Schelling, written in 1993. I actually can't quite remember the name of it, but it's about climate and global warming. Very prescient. And he was as early in the kind of the movement of UN climate action and climate commitments. And he made the parallel with NATO. And he said the success of NATO has been they have committed to actions, not targets. So countries will commit to mobilizing X number of troops and placing them in this location. And he said there's a risk that the climate journey is going too far down the routes of targets, which don't translate necessarily into success. And this has been coming to me a lot over the last 8 weeks because, of course, NATO has been front of mind. And actually, Schelling's known as a big nuclear strategist. So I keep seeing him being quoted on Twitter as people kind of debate nuclear kind of game theory. It really what supercharging is about is what works. What do we know works? Because we don't have time. We have to halve emissions between 2020 and 2030 to stay kind of anywhere roughly close to the Paris goals. And that's not to say we shouldn't have massively ambitious system change thinking, but we also need to make sure we're learning from what can deliver very, very fast change. So that's kind of the heart of Supercharge Me is what works.
You've opened up the can of worms already. You've already said. So we're gonna get into the question, what does a world work for everyone look like for you? And I want to hear each of your individual answers. Hopefully they're aligned, but if they're not, that's okay because most of my guesses are not allowed. That's a little bit down the road, but you've just opened up a plethora of new rabbit holes that we're going to go down. And I kind of want to toggle it between both of you back and forth on how we do this because you both come with your own specialties. You both have TED Talks. You've both given these TEDx talks. I've watched them both. They're really good. I like yours the most, Corinne, I have to say, because you really talk about having big balls as a woman and pissing with your brothers over the fence or over some kind of a hill. So it's fabulous. It's entertaining. And I'm sorry, she beat you out, Eric. She's got more views. She's got more views than your talk. And you're talking in some respects about the same thing, but on different things. And your experiences is so your talk was really about something totally different than hers. And it was more on this economics and policy and things on the talk. Does that just not resonate enough with people, or do you think there's some other social metrics that are underlying that are missing out? So I realize when we talk to people about economics or what model that they're living in or who's guiding the policy, and even though we have targets that Corinne talked about that are out there, if you were to ask the majority of the common man, the common person, they wouldn't know what the model is. They wouldn't know what the economic model that they're living is, if it's hedonistic, if it's capitalistic, if it's extractive, if it's circular or donut economics. They're like, what? Who? What model am I living?
I mean, I've got to be honest with you. Part of the reason behind Angrynomics, and in fact, probably the biggest debate with the title we had was, do we drop the nomics? Which was probably my instinct. Although I have to say, the publisher kind of was really strong on the Angrynomics, and actually have been kind of vindicated in terms of the sort of meme status, where then people started to use the term, oh, that's Angrynomics, whether it was, around Black Lives Matter, or whether it's around all these different protests that have been breaking out in different parts of the world, whether it's Chile or Hong Kong. But I was very attached to the ideas around anger, because anger is a universal. So what's really interesting is people say, oh, you've written a book on economics. They're kind of presuppositions that's going to be dull. You start talking to them about, have you ever thought why people go to football matches and get angry? Then they're like, that you've already got one half of the population is interested. Then you talk about, has anger affected you in your personal life? What's going on? Is it a good thing? We have all this pop psychology about releasing anger. Is that right? Or is that a bad thing? Or is that a good thing? What does it tell you? Then you have a really interesting conversation. And the economics can be a kind of afterthought. So I found that was a means to make it a lot more accessible. But I got to say, I also personally think anger is a fascinating topic on which we are highly inarticulate. But, we can come back and talk about it. This does come back to supercharge me later in the day, because I still have that framing still very relevant to me.
Well, I mean, that's why I bring it up, is because I really think, this what I'm trying to go with this is that this isn't your first rodeo. You guys have been here before. You've been doing stuff. You're working in the area, and those things have shaped and framed kind of this new emerging story and what you're seeing as a response in Supercharge Me. So how we can get some policy established, get into action, and make a transition. In the book, you guys refer a lot to Bill Gates' book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, a couple times. And, he says a couple things about food there. And I know Corinne used to do things about food. There is some strong policy on the EU level that has really emerged. Now, I don't know how that affects the United Kingdom, where you guys are at now that Brexit has come out. Maybe that's a great way to get out of all these regulations and things that are happening, or if the United Kingdom has set the bar higher. But in the EU, there, July 12th last year, the EU ESG taxonomy came out, the entire taxonomy, and it's created a major ripple effect. And just to caveat it, in my opinion, they've set the bar about as low as they can set it. I think that all businesses and organizations should strive for the higher standard and shoot above the bare minimum that they need to meet, and quit trying to catch up to reporting and standards just to appease the European Union or whatever organization or country for that. What people don't know is there's other things coming down the line, which is the CSRD is coming out at the end of, I believe it's September or October. It's already been approved and will start to roll out September, October, and we'll go into full force next year, which is basically Corporate Sustainable Reporting Directive. And it is even higher standards beyond ESG about companies of 500 employees or higher are starting to report. And so I think you're well placed in the organization that you're in, Corinne, because that's the future of how can we make sure to hold organizations' feet to the fire, do good investing. And you guys tickle upon that in the book as well. So that's kind of where I first, before we go back to policy, that's where I really want to dive into, is there's quite a substantial conversation between the two of you about ESG and about that it could be a better business model, and that there's some benefits as a better model for return and profitability compared to conventional counterparts. But I want to dive deeper into that, because you also caveat it in the book and you say, but that could maybe be misleading. And so I want you, either you, whoever wants to fight each other over answering that, I think Corinne will win, but it's up to you, both of you. I'd like to hear from you.
Necessarily. It's a very nuanced topic, and I think well worth diving into. A few thoughts just to start. One is, and we do emphasize this in the book, we both experienced a great source of optimism in the cultural change in the business and finance sector over the last 2-3 years, at least in Europe. That shift is happening in other regions, but it's most accentuated in Europe right now. You know, when I started out my career, you were in the private sector. If you were a sustainability professional, you were a weirdo. You know, you were not going to bring in any revenue. You were kind of you were like a kind of hippie agitator, you know, and now you are kind of on the board and CEO's top agenda. You know, the talent market for folks with really good climate and sustainability understanding is off the charts. There's a cultural shift has happened where I think everyone's seen the writing on the wall. They recognize you are not going to have a resilient business that withstands consumer behavior change, investor preferences, regulatory behavior changes, unless you are moving in line with what's required to at least to hit climate goals and broader biodiversity, nature, and social resilience. And the regulation point is interesting because I agree with you that the risk with these regulations is they start out lowest common denominator because of lobbying and just the process of how, you know, what it takes to actually get these through the relevant bodies. But it does change behavior. And I've seen this firsthand that disclosure is super powerful. So you said, you know, okay, corporates are already disclosing because of their investors want to, even before the new directive comes in. And both in public markets and private markets, investors are expecting quite a comprehensive level of non-financial metrics. So what do we mean by that? We mean emissions, we mean waste, we mean diversity, we mean what initiatives are you setting to try and improve all of these? How are you resourcing them? Do you actually have good governance on your climate impacts within your organization? All of these details. And what's interesting, and I've seen this in many different contexts, is once you start reporting on it, they say, oh wait, why am I in the bottom quartile? And like the competitive juices get going. These guys, they're competitive, and it is mainly guys, I'm afraid. And they think, wait, I don't want to be, people care about this stuff and I don't want to be in the bottom quartile, so I'm going to do what it takes to get into the top quartile. So it's just that act of having the data and looking at it and benchmarking against other companies is super powerful, and it gets in people's worldview, these business leaders and these investors, and that's how they start to see what it means to be successful. And that's why we have been, that's why there's an optimistic tone to the book as well, which wouldn't have been the case if we'd written the book 5 years ago, because it still felt like you were fighting the fight. You were just trying to desperately persuade everyone that this was in the interests of your financial interests as a business, because that was the only kind of mindset they recognize. Now it feels like in Europe, we're over that hump. And now it's about execution. Now it's about, okay, time is tight. That's not to say that we don't need to continue to raise the bar on regulation. We absolutely do. Because there will always be free riders, many, many free riders. And that's not to say that we shouldn't encourage massive holding corporates to accountability. Sorry, I'm not phrasing that right. Accountability. Because that is one of, that's another thing we go into in the book. That's actually one of the most powerful things individuals can do in terms of climate action or kind of broader global goals action. Business, corporate world, actually the bigger players are super, super sensitive to their reputation and to kind of their perception on these things. And we as individuals have never been more powerful with social media. So that's not to say, oh, great, it's solved. You know, business is on the path. Not at all. We have to keep agitating and we have to keep driving the regulation up. But we're in a very different place where there's a lot more cause for optimism.
My question had about five sub-questions in it, Eric, and you can jump on any of them or all of them if you'd like to give us your angle as well.
Yeah, maybe just a couple of really quick points. So one of the themes that runs through the book is that that we're a movement without a manifesto at the moment. Okay? So the example I always give is if Greta Thunberg was in power, what would she actually do? So what would her first week of legislation be? And that's kind of my frustration. When I look at an awful lot of the literature here, I don't know what the answer to that question is. You know, you mentioned the Bill Gates book. There's a couple of things in there, but there ain't much. And that's what we've tried to provide. So the first thing I always do, you know, my day job, I spend a lot of time in ESG meetings. You know, for people who aren't aware, this is this kind of acronym that's come up in financial markets of environmental and social and governance. So people are trying to measure these criteria and weight these criteria in their investment decision making. Well, the first question you got to ask yourself is, what are we actually trying to achieve? I mean, beyond, you know, the reduction of emissions at a practical level, What is the consequence of all of this environmental social governance scoring? What does it do at a system level? Not, you know, not just that as an individual asset manager or private equity fund or whoever you are, or individual fund, what's it going to do systematically? And so that's one of the things we try and address. And then I'll try and observe on what's happening. And what I would say is, I would say part of our kind of thesis is that the real challenge here is one of capital expenditure. So we can't avoid a clear diagnosis of the problem. Now, I can already see a lot of people are going, capital expenditure, I should switch off right there. Yeah, the basic point is we need to do investment primarily in electricity generation. So my simple kind of, you know, cut to the chase on this is, let's make electricity sustainable and let's run as much as we can off the grid, right? And if we do that, depending on whose numbers you believe, maybe we can get 70, 75% of emissions down. That's the goal. So I immediately say, I go in an ESG meeting, I say, how are you helping? Right? Because I don't want just to have a good looking portfolio. I want you to be contributing to this objective. I want to know, how are we going to make electricity sustainable and how are we going to get everybody on the grid? Now, broadly speaking, I actually think ESG is contributing to that objective, but it really helps to be clear about it. And the way it's doing it really is it is, and one has to try and convey this in a way that's free of jargon, is the most important factor in determining investment decisions is the cost of capital. You could think of it like an interest rate. What we really want is the carbon industry to be paying really high interest rates so they don't make any investments. Right? So if you're Greta and you want to cut off all new oil and gas investments, let's make it incredibly expensive through interest rates on those activities. And then if it's really positive activities, let's say it's offshore wind and solar panels, let's make them have an incredibly low interest rate so that we encourage a huge acceleration in those investments. And I would say what I observe in financial markets is that's kind of what's happening.
That's interesting because if mostly in the Western world that were to occur as far as energy or the carbon emitters, and what we're also talking about is this scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions and, you know, where they lie as an organization, but also in the investment portfolio and how they're addressed. But then don't those organizations just find a workaround and they just head on over to some place in India or Africa or somewhere off of Montenegro, Croatia, and just build another coal power plant or an offshore drilling or something like that to kind of go around these higher rules and regulations? And they kind of prey on those countries that have this resource curse or are in desperate need of jobs and monies or whatever to forego those? Or do you see this more as an international or a global type of a policy or standard?
If I could just say some very quick observation on that. So what I kind of described, and I think both of our experience on the disclosures and the ESG is broadly positive, but we have a section which is beware the three hyphens. And the three hyphens are greenwashing, which is broadly where, yeah, you know, I make my own portfolio look very good, but really it's not having much significant impact whatsoever. The other one is misselling, which is the idea that's popular that, oh, you can have fantastic returns and also, you know, feel good about yourself and be impacting the planet, which that may or may not be the case, but one doesn't want to state that as some kind of universal law because it really isn't. And if anything, the evidence, if there is evidence, it would probably point in the opposite direction. And then the third point is free riding. And I think that's what you've exactly alluded to. And we are acutely aware of that. And I think that's a live problem. My hope, though, however, is that how do we tackle this? I think it's being tackled because this movement is just broadening out. So the scope for effectively bad actors here, being a bad actor is incredibly high risk. I mean, we've already seen big financial institutions where the regulator has identified greenwashing. This is huge reputational risk. And, both of us work at big financial institutions. Leadership shareholders are acutely aware of this because, I don't know whether it was Warren Buffett who said, it takes 50 years to build a reputation, you can lose it in an hour. So that's a profound point. And then maybe the other dimension on the global point is we have this idea of a green Bretton Woods, which you've kind of alluded to, which is, you're absolutely right. We divide the world into who's capital constrained and who isn't. And this is who has financial resources and who doesn't. And the key has to be when we look at a country like India or South Africa, they are financially constrained. If we want to have an impact, we have to loosen that financial constraint. And actually, we're a lot more powerful than people realize.
And I would just add on, it's not the multinationals who are disclosing and setting corporate targets who are then building coal power plants in Montenegro, say. It is the kind of the bad actors, say, who for whatever reason are not part of a system. Maybe they're not listed, or they're in a sector where maybe there's less scrutiny, or they're willing to take that risk. But this is the why are the big companies not doing it when there might be a return on it? Well, this is the genius of the Scopes framework, the GHG reporting protocol, which it's so funny. Even yesterday, you hear time and time again people like, "I don't understand. It's double counting. It doesn't make sense." People struggle with it, but the reality is it's absolute genius because it forces companies or institutions to take a systems view. It forces them to think about their wider network of decision making and suppliers and customers, and so, once a company is disclosing publicly across the scopes, there's no room to do some building, procuring from a coal power plant without being punished for it.
So to be clear, the scopes mean that you're not just, as a business, if you do scopes, you're not just responsible for your own direct emissions, but also those in your supply chain and those of your
Exactly, the
customers.
emissions of anywhere in your broader network, any products you're buying or services you're buying, and any emissions of your products down in their use life, even if you've already sold them.
Most organizations are still that you're speaking a different language to them. You're from outer space, so. So the scope 1, 2, and 3 is upstream and downstream emissions. Scope one, I believe it's scope one is upstream. Scope three is downstream, or is it scope one is direct emissions, and then the other two are upstream and downstream. So supply chain, where does your product or services go after? It is really complex. I just got done speaking to about 3,000 Deloitte consultants on ESG, the CSRD, and going through that. I gave a big keynote on environment and kind of where we're moving with models, because that's the talk of all the organizations that they consult. And the other thing is, I've been doing this since really getting heavy into ESG discussion with others for the last 7 years. It's been on the radar, and nobody's kind of been listening because the standard wasn't there. Nobody's holding their feet to the fire. And now I've had clients and bankers come back to me and say, "Hey, we're having to go to our customers and say, we can't be your bank anymore because of the things that you're doing." That's the situation that we're in. So those who are doing bad, who aren't complying, who aren't looking after the environment and those things, they're losing their banks. They're losing their support structure to continue business as usual. And that's what, for me, is just an eye-opener. It's unbelievable in that. And I really appreciate you both kind of diving deeper into the ESG and into that model, and also that it's evolving, that we know when the ESG taxonomy comes out, we're already 7 years behind because they've been working on it. Now, if we don't get on board now and kind of set the bar higher or set our sights higher, we're just going to be chasing after the ball the whole time.
And one other thing I would add, I'm sure many of the listeners, it's always hard to know what listeners do and don't know, because I'm sure there's a broad spectrum, but listeners who work in this field will be aware of this, that there's been a, when I say this field, I mean, sorry, financial services and investment houses. There's been a real shift as well in what responsible action and responsible investing looks like, from exclusion. So we won't touch anything that has high emissions or, you know, uses plastics, or to what we call brown to green or transformation, which is actually, if we don't touch it, they're just going to continue doing it. Isn't it better to bring it into our sphere of influence and try and make it better? And that's in a shifting, but that's complicated, right? Because you have to really work out, okay, what's an appropriate pace of change, you know, that you feel comfortable with. And it does usually require investing without immediate returns. You know, often making yourself sustainable is more expensive in the near term. And there are returns in the longer term, but they're often not as immediate as our kind of business structure is set out to expect.
There are a lot of economists on my show and a lot of people who are authors around economics. So I had John Elkington, who wrote The Green Swans, on the podcast. And I don't know if you guys know, but I'll tell you that most of the people I talk to don't know that at the 25-year mark in 2018, John Elkington recalled the triple bottom line, which he came up with, you know, 29 years ago now. He recalled it. He said, we're using it as an accounting principle. It's being greenwashed. It's being used in the total wrong way. I'm recalling it. The great thing about a recall is, I don't know if you've had any products or food or anything recalled before in your life, is they usually fix the problem and they come back and they come out with a new one, or sometimes they pull it off totally. And that's the real interesting thing with the EU taxonomy, the CSRD, and many other things that are going on. The models are already there. They exist. They've been around for a long time. So I don't want to give away your entire book, but you really kind of, in the beginning, to me, it came out like you're really strong on policy. And so I don't know if this is something that you want to address, Eric, or if it's Corinne that has involved more there or not. Sure. Why do you say it's policy? Do we have democracy? Can that policy help? Do they know what the hell they're doing? Tell us about it.
A big theme of ours is that there's a failure of the mind. And, you know, we one of the sort of purposes of the book is that we should be in a situation where most informed citizens can give you the three things the government should be doing about climate change. I mean, there's no point in having a vote if you don't know what to do with it, right? And this is the major problem I have is we have people on the streets, we have Extinction Rebellion, we have lots of protests going on, but we still don't have clarity about what we need to do. And that's sort of mission number one in terms of the book's objective. And in a sense, we have an answer to that question, which is it's really simple. We want the green option to be cheaper everywhere. That's a sort of, that is your policy goal. I want every single time I'm confronted with a carbon option or a green option, the green option's cheaper.
Can I just step back and put this into context a bit? Because I think we're big on policy, and absolutely our perspective is, it might sound a bit like we're sort of free marketeers and we wouldn't put ourselves in an economic box like that. But our perspective is this transition is not going to happen at the pace it's needed without some pretty ambitious policies. And that links to our, you know, this thing we repeat quite often around realism. So we are grounded in realism and pragmatism about what we've learned about what it takes to get people to change and businesses to change. And we have this, you know, saying that individuals only change their behavior if an option is better, or if their friends are doing it, you know, social norms. Companies only change their behavior if it's more profitable, if it's illegal. And politicians change their behavior to get elected or stay in power. And it's a generalization. Obviously, there are exceptions, but it's a pretty good rule of thumb for behavior.
It is a great rule of thumb.
Right. So we started with that about, okay, this is mass change needed on every level in the system. What do we know about change? And we've both studied individual behavior change and institutional behavior change in various ways over our careers. Now, you take those principles, we're not going to get where we need to go without regulation and without policy. So that's like the first piece. And yes, this green option's cheaper comes out of our study. You know, we started with what is supercharging. Supercharging's taking what's worked and doing it 100-fold. When you look at what's worked in terms of really transitioning to lower emissions technologies or really reducing emissions at a national level or a city level, it tends to be these what we call EPICs, or extreme positive incentives for change. So it's an individual and institution is massively incentivized essentially to transition, be it from ICE, you know, petrol cars to electric vehicles, or be it from a gas and oil based energy system to a wind and solar based energy system. And that this links, you know, so we kind of came at this from two, from both the theoretical level and the empirical level. We said, what's worked? Oh, look, here's a common thread. It's all positive incentives. And then we thought, what do we know about human and institutional behavior change? People are not very good at changing their behavior unless there's a carrot there. So that's where we come to the conclusion that we need to do what it takes at a policy level to get the low carbon or the greener option cheaper. And that has to, this is also where we struggle a bit with, we need system change, but we also need to take a sector by sector view because there's such different levers required in different sectors. You know, when you...
I think there's a really important point here as mm-hmm. well, which is, that a lot of the policy in economics has been hijacked by a kind of carbon taxes and carbon pricing. Mm. And we push back against that very aggressively. And the way we do that is around this idea of making the green option cheaper. Because if you want to make the green option cheaper, you need to have a green option, right? So it automatically actually gives you the right sequencing. There is no point in putting really high taxes on things that people really need to spend their money on and they have no alternative. Like, we always make this joke that if a carbon tax is successful, it'll raise no revenue, right? Because we'll all collapse our use of whatever it is. Okay, all these schemes like to say we're going to redistribute the funds from carbon tax revenues, that would be a disaster because that means you're still emitting a whole load of carbon, right? So emitting a whole load of emissions. So we really want to focus on substitutes. And
but I would add this, making that, you know, there was an Economist article about this idea that slightly misunderstood our position on carbon taxes, which we don't actually go into in that much detail in the book. I think we spend a few paragraphs on it, which is not that we're anti-carbon taxes. They have a really important role to play in this. It's just they aren't the end goal. The end goal is make the green option cheaper and more attractive. And they are one tool amongst many tools to deliver that. And if you just make that the end goal, you're missing a whole load of other pieces you need to deliver, which is making sure you're driving massive R&D where there aren't yet substitutes such as cement or air fuel, and the full range of policy levers. And the other piece that that we struggle with carbon taxes sort of dominating the debate is there is a massive hearts and minds battle to be had. And we get, obviously we're exposed mainly to the UK policy debate, but get very frustrated with how many TV talk shows or radio shows, everyone's talking about the sacrifices that have to be made and who's going to pay for this, who's going to pay for net zero. This is going to be a cost at the household level and the government level, which is not what the economic shows. Economic history shows that people are going to be better off, you know, on average. The only people who will lose will be the owners of the fossil fuel assets who are super concentrated, you know, in the 0.1% anyway. So there's also a piece around, yes, we need carbon taxes in some way, but they shouldn't be the highlight. You know, the highlight message should be there's a whole range of policy tools and you're all going to benefit from this. And we are really seeing firsthand in the UK, there's a kind of anti-net zero brigade emerging. You know, there's a political war emerging over this, and we need to be politically savvy about how we're fighting it.
Well, there's a bunch of things that we need to address and go even deeper in. So Eric, you're absolutely spot on. You're right. Greener needs to be more affordable than the non-green options, the business as usual, the high carbon scenario. I'm totally in line with that. I want to change or throw in some caveats that it needs to be cheaper. I think that if we cheapen anything, if we cheapen food products, then we cheapen life. And I think that everybody should be paid a fair value for the products and services. And if we're doing it because of subsidies, we're making it cheaper because of subsidies or because policy, then that could potentially be a real big benefit. I want to really say, though, the greener option, the renewable option, the environmentally friendly option, the ESG option on any product, on anything that we're talking about, is not only a better business model, but it's automatically more affordable. And let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. Because it's green, it's renewable. Those high costs of a lot of things that are going on are reduced because you're generating renewable energy that's endless. You're storing it in batteries. You're using all these new advancements to actually reduce the cost of goods sold in your product, making them more affordable to those that are high carbon products or in line with those high carbon products. One thing that most people don't know, with especially around the sustainable development goals, it should take us about $94 trillion US dollars to reach the sustainable development goals by 2030. But what they don't know, they're like, holy, that's a big number. That's a huge number. They can't even fathom it. But if we just did the high carbon scenario, business as usual, we're going to spend $89 trillion US dollars regardless. That means when the building gets old, we just tear it down and build another one. When the tires are worn out, we just put on new ones. You know, it's this high carbon scenario of the way we do life business. That's going to cost us $89 trillion regardless. It's only $14 trillion more to do it renewably, to do it regeneratively, to do it with a different model. So that model works better. So it's not only let's make it cheaper or let's make it greener, more affordable. It actually is, because it's a better business model. And what you guys have heard, and I'm sure we can talk about this as well, is that the high carbon products or fossil fuel products are really stranded assets. They're a losing game. You're investing against your future, but they're a bad investment everywhere. And the only thing comparable to that bad investment is anything to do with animal products. Any kind of cows or meat or stuff is really turning about the same level of bad investment that you can make. And they're seeing all these regulations come in with all sorts of pressures. And so I wanted to address that in the last caveat, because you brought this up, Corinne, in the beginning about the Ukraine war. Not only economists, not only politicians, but in general, people are saying, if we just got rid of the reliance on fossil fuels from Russia and the commodities of food and grain from the Ukraine, there wouldn't be nothing to fight about. The war could, yeah. So I want to get your opinions and kind of talk a little bit more about that, please.
This is a big theme in the book, is who are the losers? And again, we tend to frame it in terms of this idea of stranded assets, which is it is the owners of polluting assets and the people employed in the polluting industries that are the losers. Now, what's interesting is when you do the numbers, because I think there's a lot of scaremongering here. So people have been told, oh, if we, you know, if we collapse emissions, your pension fund is going to be in trouble, all this sort of stuff. And the numbers simply do not support this. I mean, this is a form of propaganda. So our analysis suggests, well, who owns it? The punchline is it's the thugocracies. We don't need to name them. They're pretty obvious today who they are. It's the theocracies, of which there's one primary example. And it's the 1%. And in fact, it's only a fraction of the 1%. So, you know, you refer to Angrinomics, which I co-authored with Mark Blythe, you know, where we go into an awful lot, the trends in wealth inequality. One of the upsides there is if you look at the fossil fuel industry listed on the stock market, you are talking about less than 1% of the market value of the entire stock market. Now, that's what is, you know, a couple of days move in the stock market. It really isn't that significant. And we're talking about 1%, which of the assets which are owned by 1%, right? 1% of 1% should definitely not be holding up, you know, progress on climate change. I mean, that is an absolute travesty. Now, that's just on the asset side of things. So we have nothing to fear financially from, frankly, accelerating the depreciation or destroying the value of carbon assets. Now, then you think, okay, there are people employed in that industry. Again, the global numbers are very encouraging. You're talking about less than 1% of the global labor force. And again, you know, we can create 1% jobs in a year of the global labor force, not to mention all of the industries that you're describing, which are sustainable in the totality of their costs and benefits into the medium term, will employ way more than 1% of the global population. And yeah, and then I think, you know, so the crux of the matter is that we can live in a more peaceful world, and the actual prospect for us to create assets and create jobs far exceeds the potential loss.
Can I just add this point, though, around costs? And you're right, the kind of the carbon model economy cost is about the same. But, you know, we also get frustrated with the use of the word cost in this context, which is very, you know, my ex-employer McKinsey did a great report on what's it going to take to get to, you know, to 1.5. And it was this $9 trillion a year cost. And that freaks everyone out. But it's also, it's this slippery thing of, it's not a cost in the pure sense, it's an investment. And the analogy we use in the book is the difference between spending, you know, spending money on a holiday versus spending money on an extension for your house. And you know, this is a bit brute economist, because there is of course value to a holiday, but it's not financial value. When you spend money on it, that money's gone. You know, you don't have an asset out of it. When you spend money on an extension on your house, you're adding value to the house. And the money we're spending on the restructuring of our economy to be sustainable, it's an investment. We're creating assets that have value, and that's a very important reconfiguration of what we're talking about. We're not just throwing money down the toilet. And that's not even getting on to the savings for not having to spend huge amounts of money on adaptation and sort of disaster management down the road, which of course we're already down that line. It's just, how bad is it going to be?
Mark, could I come back to your point here, because I think it's a profoundly important one, about this whole point about, you know, make the green option cheaper. Mm. And you're absolutely right. When you view holistic cost benefits, that shouldn't even be a policy objective. That is inherently the case, because the sustainable option is sustainable by definition, mm. and the unsustainable options are unsustainable. But I want to give you a really practical, though concrete, example of the kind of approach we take in the book. If I look at the cement industry, right, there is a perception, which again, I think is largely a perception created by vested interests, or certainly vested interests are aligned with this perception, which is that we don't have substitutes. So what do we do as a policy response? Okay, so then we get the European Commission looks at the cement industry, consults with the cement industry, and says, okay, there aren't really any substitutes, but we do need cement, it's essential. So we'll agree to what we think the technology will do, and then we'll have a cap and some variant of a cap and trade system. We'll decide this rate of decline of emissions, and then we'll price it, and we'll encourage the industry to transform. I'm right from the outset, no. Okay, that is not the right policy. If you look at our book, the right policy is make the green option cheaper. Mm. So I want policy from day one to go, you find me a substitute today, and I want it in the open market, that substitute to be cheaper. And then we can come up with fancy little cap and trade systems and work out carbon pricing, because let me tell you, the substitute does exist, or we're going to throw billions of capital to do the R&D to get the substitute. And then what we're going to do is we're going to price it cheaper and collapse the carbon intensive cement industry. So you're absolutely right. Like, cement is not a sustainable business. It's destroying the planet. Okay. But what I want to do is make the very narrow market price. My market price is going to be my lever. And I'm going to say, right, I want to attack that immediately as the objective of policy. And what's interesting about that is it's a subtle switch from what economists call pricing and externality to what we talk about, which is the price elasticity of demand, collapsing demand. But it pushes you in a completely different policy direction.
I love that. And I appreciate your explaining, because we do need to get there. And so I think most of our listeners are seeing that we're going into more depth and substance and into the understanding of what the book's about and what some of what you address. I want people to go out and read it. I don't want to give them the cliff notes or the full compilation of it so that they're lazy and don't read it. I want them to read it. It's a nice read. It's a nice dialogue between both of you. Another rabbit hole that we probably need to touch upon, or at least scratch the surface and get your views and opinion, because we've talked about it, but we haven't gone in to address it. And it's also tickled in the book as well, is this net zero. So there's a new book from Paul Hawken and Andrew Winston called Net Positive. And I am very much aligned with this way of thinking that net zero, if we strive or achieve net zero, humanity's dead. We're basically flatlining. We're made of carbon. We need carbon to grow plants and for them to capture and to use as fuel. And we're carbon-based people. And so if we go net zero, that's basically telling the world we're flatlining, we're dead. We need to go net positive. And this is part of what you're talking about. The green is more affordable. Green is a better option. And this, we need to capture more carbon. We need to leave the planet better than we found it in our business models. And the business models, whether it's Google or Apple or Patagonia or whoever you want to address, that have a form of planetary services or this environmental social governance in the core of their business model, where they're actually giving back or trying to leave the planet better than they found it, we're finding out that it takes a very old economic principle about Earth overshoot or the ecological footprint and leaves it in a positive way that maybe we could go like, I don't agree with this from John Elkington, where he says regenerative capitalism, but that we're regenerating or leaving the planet better so that we'll have resources in the future, so that we'll have products to produce in the future. So I want to kind of get your feeling on that.
You know, these are very, very thoughtful areas. And I think the bit where I'm optimistic here, Mark, is that I think what's happening with solar power and with wind is a little bit like semiconductors. I mean, people underappreciate the fact that semiconductor, it's Moore's law, right, is the consistent collapse in the price of semiconductors. You know, that has been such a fundamental driver of the elements of human activity that have been progress over the last 40, 50 years. And I think, you know, we can conceivably, if you look at the rate of technological progress that's happening within wind and solar, we could arrive at a point where these things are extraordinarily cheap. And I think the kind of creative challenge for all businesses is if we made electricity plentiful and zero carbon, what are we then going to do in a productive way with that surfeit of capacity to do all of the regenerative activities to become, you know, net positive, as it were? That feels to me, from an economics perspective, in a sense, what the kind of 10, 20 year objective has got to be.
Yeah. And I would also add, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, before we started recording, my background's in more holistic sustainability, not just climate. And I've been very alert in writing and talking about this book that we're at fault in some ways because we chose just to focus on this, how do we collapse emissions in the next 10, 15 years, rather than thinking about the holistic systems change. Because it's much harder. But I do also believe there's learnings, right? If we're tapping into what we're trying to answer is how do we radically change policy, how business works, and deploy individual power to its maximum. If we can learn from that, we can then deploy it to broader kind of the broader sustainable development goals.
Love that. I really do.
This, you know, the John Elkington, we do have to start incorporating net positive regenerative thinking into our system, you know, otherwise our great grandchildren, what are they going to be left with? So their contribution to this dialogue is critical, and it's at a different level. It's a bit less pragmatic. It's a bit less clear what are the things we do in the next 3 to 5 years, but we need it, and it will start filtering into the pragmatic.
Yeah, and it's really about, so when the subtitle of the book is Net Zero Faster, Which I agree, because when you see this, whether it's Moore's law for semiconductors or computing power or Metcalfe's law or whatever you see, that's an exponential growth. That's a doubling over time. But there is an ecological phenomenon called symbiosis and regeneration that also has that exponential function. There's also this divergence or awakening that neoliberalism, neo-Darwinism really doesn't exist, that it's not survival of the fittest, natural selection, only the strong survive severe competition. That is directly the opposite. The more we cooperate and collaborate on these goals, on doing things to heal the planet, on better business models and practices, that we actually step out of incremental growth or siloed thinking and growth into this exponential curve. And that's why, you know, when I kind of touch upon this better business model or better model in general to move in this direction, that it also has that exponential function, which when I read the book, I see, you know, supercharge me. That's what I see, you know, that how do we get on the exponential curve towards climate change or towards environmental action, activism to solve some of these problems. And that's kind of how you guys tie up the book as well, as on some firm actions and things that people can do.
Mark, that I think is really, really important, because I come from a small country. You know, I grew up in Ireland. And yes, you know, this is something that we try to address in the book as well, particularly when it comes to, say, the Scandinavian countries. But you go to Ireland, you know, Ireland is a tiny, tiny fraction of global emissions. And so there's a natural pushback where people go, why do we need a change? Because, you know, this is up to, you know, it depends what happens to the coal industry in India, what the Chinese do, right? You repeatedly hear this. But to your point, you know, exponential change in human behavior can start with a tiny, tiny fraction. And that's one of the really important messages that we make. Whether you're an individual activist, you know, if you look at the actual numbers, you know, a tiny number of activists have created so many examples of change. We use the example of Timberland in the book with the Brazilian sourcing their leather products in Brazil. That's a tiny number of people, and they made a huge change. And the example, you know, we were in Ireland recently, we made exactly the same point. It's like the power of example. If you show what you can do, you know, if Ireland could become self-sufficient in wind power in less than a decade, have the lowest electricity prices in the Eurozone, you know, electrify, people will copy you, right? And, you know, that is leadership, but that is also, as you describe it, these incredibly potentially powerful examples. And that's somewhere where I am genuinely very optimistic. The whole planet is trying to solve this problem. We have so many individuals, so much creativity, so much energy, that if we collectively put our minds to these things and we watch and learn, it's another big theme in the book, is let's look to anywhere in the world where there's been success and copy it. Mm. Right? That instead of us all trying to decide we're going to have our own little national plan, Now forget that. You know, there's amazing behavioral change happening in lots of parts of the world that we can copy, and then it what starts as a little shift becomes a tidal wave.
That's fabulous. I absolutely love that. I want to go into, you tickle this in the book a little bit, but I want to kind of ask you, Eric, as your expertise in economics, but also you, Corinne, as how you see the world on this climate angle. We are, as humanity, are being bombarded since 2015, since even before, with these new economic models. And we don't even know it. I mean, some of us are, yeah, circular economy. So there's donut economics, there's circular economy, there's planetary boundaries, there are ecological economics, there's ecological footprint, there's mission economics, there's steady state economics. Then there's obviously extractive economics, capitalism, you know, and we could go on and on. Now we've got this, you know, angry economics. The one I like the best, and I'm teasing, is Trekonomics. I love Trekonomics. I think that, I don't know if you've read that book, It's the economy of the future. How do people have an like Star Trek, work and have jobs as doctors, lawyers, ships, captains, whatever? There's no money. There's no monetary policy. They're doing this for the good of the, you know, the future of space travel and going where no man has ever gone before or something like that. And really, are they all these models at once? Are we doing them all at once? Is it one model that we need to merge to? How do we understand that? And, you know, Kate Raworth obviously says it great. She says, we're still learning this outdated form of economics in school. And, you know, the other one is Tim Jackson and CUSP, post-growth and degrowth models. He's also an ecological economist. How do we make sense of this without our brains exploding, without saying, boy, that's too complex. I have no idea what we're doing. Let's just get up, give up, bury our head in the sand. Give us a little advice and help from your perspective. And how do we integrate Supercharge Me into all this other, they're good models. There's a lot of good models, but how do we make sense and kind of move in the right direction? And what are you guys doing on your website or to help people kind of sift through all that?
Sure. Well, so I'm a huge fan, I mean, of all of these areas of economics. And you know, somebody who's been studying economics for longer than I should have been, I think I got interested in it as a teenager. But the I've always believed, of course, if you read widely enough, it's always been hugely eclectic, right? Of course, in any discipline, there's a mainstream. But you, if you look hard enough, you'll find loads and loads of other ideas. So I'm a huge fan of all of these developments. And I actually am involved with a UK government funded program called Rebuilding Macroeconomics, which has been exactly about trying to encourage and fund a lot of innovative thinking along the lines that you've described. There's one caveat, though. When I look at the research program and talk to researchers, I always want to ask them, and I say to them all, so what are we going to do differently? So I think it's great from a pedagogic standpoint that we make the study of economics proper. I mean, I think the economics I was taught was not the real thing, right? We just left out 80% of what's incredibly important, you know? But once we've educated everybody, let's get 100% or as close as we can when we're educating. But how does it translate into what we're going to do? And that is where that's really, again, to me, a key role of the book. Because I do not like the fact that when it comes down to it, the people who won this debate at a practical policy level were people saying it's an externality. Get the price of it right, introduce taxes, have a global carbon scheme. And I'm going, and unfortunately, and that to me is not good enough. And it's not working. It's not the way to transform. So that's my kind of challenge to the new models.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that I would absolutely agree. They are incredibly important antagonists to the current system. And that's what's phenomenal, you know, the Kate Raworth donut economics model, it's a paradigm shift. It's a completely different way of thinking about our economic activity. But we need to continue to develop those new models of thinking into action. And that's why, you know, they're really important, but they are often at this this high level, as I mentioned earlier. And that's what we really were trying to do with the book is, let's get practical. What are the actions that we need to do at all these different levels, individual level, corporate level, financial institutions, national level, what are the things we need to do in the next 5 years? And you want to be drawing on those paradigms. You want to be thinking in a regenerative way, you know, but they don't, that's the next level of impactfulness. Let's put it that way. Currently they're impactful because they're changing mindsets. And as you say, they're changing pedagogy, but we need to bring them into that. And Kate Raworth is doing this with the Donut Economics Lab. They've got a whole city pilot in Amsterdam, you know, so she's bringing it to the practical level. I'm not saying they're not, but that's the next level of impactfulness. And, you know, as is always the way, that the future and or the intellectually right answer will be some combination of all of them, you know, and we need all of them to be contributing.
Yeah, it's like I'm a big believer. This is a quote from Paul Samuelson, who was a much truer to this than one might imagine, because he's sort of perceived to be a kind of mainstream neoclassical economist. Paul Samuelson said, "I'm eclectic because nature's eclectic." And I agree with that. So I, you know, for somebody who in a different level as a kind of professional investor in financial markets has used economics, I think every situation is very often a different economic model. You know, so if I take a really simple point here, if we want to make our electricity, you know, zero emissions, that's the economics of regulated utilities. And in fact, again, what inspired us to write the book is I would go straight to the index of all of these books on climate change and show, where do you show me how to accelerate investment in regulated utilities? Very few people talk about that. There's a really simple policy fix there.
And then
just make this one point. All you need to do to accelerate investment is provide price support. If you de-risk the electricity price, you will create a huge acceleration in sustainable energy investment. Now, that is super simple.
Yeah, and just to build,
and yet incredibly powerful.
And to build on that, we have a whole mix of types of economics needed. So the economics of sustainable diets, you know, huge agriculture is 20% of emissions. The majority of that is meat and dairy. That's behavioral economics. There you really are then focusing on how do you change individual behavior. And what we know about that, well, individuals are hugely impacted by availability, by social norms. And that's a complete solving for a completely different kind of thing to the regulated utilities point, you know. And then there's the economics of innovation, say, in the cement case. So I think we haven't actually talked about this explicitly, even though I think it's sort of there in the book, but it is this idea of you need to bring in different economic lenses for different parts of the problem.
Well, what's your favorite actionable takeaway from the book that somebody could go out and apply or put into practice that you like the most?
At an individual level, personally, I've been hugely influenced by listening to Roger Hallam, who's the co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. I don't know if you've had him on the show or, but I, you know, I think actually one of the things I really like, he's got a great YouTube video, which is, How to stop climate change in 6 months.
Yeah.
And this is really about civil resistance. And it's very influenced by the work of Erica Chenoweth and others about the who've done very interesting historical analysis. And the thing, we talk about this in the book, it is minority rule. Is the reality is the people who are motivated to engineer social change starts with a very small number of people. Now, obviously, at some level, they're tapping into a universal. I mean, as human beings, we universally care about our grandchildren and care about saving the planet. But it's only a small minority who are really motivated to go out on the street and lie down in front of a car and say, I'm going to go to prison until you guys sort this out. Okay. And their point is that if you get, you know, he makes the point in the UK, I think if 3,000 people go to prison, you'll get legislative change, because as a civilized society, we just can't tolerate, you know, all of our best and brightest students behind bars, right? We're going to negotiate change. So in a way, I think I would almost encourage people to start there, because then you go, right, I have power, because there is power in small numbers. The thing that's missing from Roger Hallam is, you know, right now I'm motivated, but you go, so what I want to happen? And that's the part that we try to answer in the book is, if you want to know what we actually at a practical level then need to do, when the government sits down at the table with Extinction Rebellion and says, okay, let's draw up the legislation, this is the piece of legislation you want to be fighting for.
Wonderful. Did you have something to add, Corinne?
Well, just to exactly, you know, We got some feedback when we were drafting the book that it felt like we were trying to speak to too broad an audience. And we were. We were trying to make it super accessible to someone who had no prior knowledge of the topic. And we were trying to address kind of expert climate policymakers, you know. So we were trying to potentially be overambitious. And many of the recommendations are directed at that, you know, folks running companies, folks running financial institutions, policymakers. But the individual piece, I just wanted to ease
And the
this piece
worker
around.
actually is something you talk
Yeah,
about a
well, I just
lot.
want to add, our conclusion on the individual power is, of course, we all need to strive towards individual behaviour change, but the most powerful thing you can do is activism. But there's different sort of loci of activism, and you're talking to the kind of national legislative change, but there's something I've seen a lot in kind of clients in the corporate environment is the power of the employee, who employees have no idea how much power they have.
Yeah.
You know, I see the other side of recruiting and companies desperately trying to work on their brand towards employers, and they don't recruits in the market don't understand actually the power balance. And I've heard executives say so many occasions that interviewees are asking, well, what are you doing on climate? What's your climate action? And that alone influences change at the corporate level. Or it might be the community level. So, everyone kind of needs to do a bit of almost influence mapping about where in your life is there a power structure that you can tap into.
Love that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. There is one last hard question that I have for you guys. And then, a few others that are not so hard, but this will be the hardest question I have for you. And I want you to each answer it individually. And I told you what it would be in the beginning. I want to know from each of you, what does a world that works for everyone look like for you? Not for policymakers, not for someone else, not for your organization, for you. What does a world that works for everyone look like for you? And, whoever wants to go first. I don't want to start any fights between you two.
It's quite, to me, I actually got into climate through the humanitarian lens. I came into it as a humanitarian issue. As we all know, we're already seeing many populations suffer, and it's, as is always the way, it's already the more vulnerable and the disadvantaged who are impacted disproportionately. And for me, a world that works for everyone is around a fundamental level of human dignity for everyone on the planet. And that means not having to worry about the basics of feeding your family and protecting your family from violence, and having opportunity for self-fulfillment and self-expression. And we're a long way from that. But yeah, I fundamentally am a kind of humanitarian climate. And it's not that I don't care about the environment, but I was motivated to it through the humanitarian implications, which are massive.
Eric?
I mean, it's such a great question.
Hmm.
I think, and maybe I'm heavily influenced by this at the moment because of the war that's happening in Europe, which is so devastating, I think, to virtually everybody in terms of how one sees the world and how one thinks about human progress, because you view this as appalling human regression, that as human beings we have greater technological power than we've ever had in human history, as a matter of fact. And yet we are utilizing that power to do untold damage, which will last for generations. So what chance do we have to oppose that dynamic where the extraordinary resources that we have are used to the betterment of the globe? And humankind is failing currently in that objective. And we only have ourselves to blame. And I tend to think that the first way that we stand any chance of dealing with this is through the politicization of every human being. And I think this is where we start completely at a local level. And if we contribute anything, it is at the margins, it is to that objective. So I think the objective of a policymaker or a writer or a thinker is, and this is something that Kate Raworth, you mentioned with Donut Economics, I think one of the things that's brilliant about what she does is how she makes it accessible.
Mm.
And this was really one of probably the hardest thing in the book, was to make it something that my my youngest, my daughter, who's, you know, was 16, 17 at the time, I want her to start reading it and not put it down until she's finished. And I want her to feel empowered and to be clear about what we need to do collectively. And I think this is relevant at multiple levels. You know, what the war is revealing is about how dictators, who typically tend to be elderly men in pursuit of power, are afraid of true democracy. And I don't mean democracy as a Western idea. I mean democracy as a human idea. It dates back to the Greeks. It's been there through all time. It's a universal idea about knowing what's in our collective interest and being represented and fighting for what we believe is progress. So that's the fight, I think, ultimately. And that will translate into a much more sustainable world. You have the SDG badge right there. That's the goal. The way to get there is that as many, many parts of humankind are politicized and know what we need to do.
So it's almost what you're saying. It's that we have to fight for what we want, kind of. I love that. I absolutely love it. We're still not done. I have more questions for you, but before we go on to those, is there anything in the book that you didn't get to tell us about that you really want to make sure we understand and have covered here today or talk about before I go on to my last final questions for you?
I think so.
There's just one really simple thing, and again, I come with massive apologies here. I'm just going to be an economist for 2 seconds. But one of the things that made me very optimistic when I looked at this as an economics problem is that if you start with making electricity sustainable, we do not realize it is insufficiently well recognized how fortunate we are for two very simple reasons. One is that the lead times on sustainable electricity generation are incredibly short, right? So you can build a wind farm that could power villages and a solar farm that can power millions of homes. You can do that in 12 to 18 months, right? So this is really about determination, right? And it is cheaper electricity, okay? So you could bring down your electricity prices. And you could absolutely get to at least 70 or 80% sustainable electricity within 5-year timelines in all of the most important geographies of the world, right? That is just simply that is now a widely recognized fact within expertise, but that should be broadly known. That's the first key point to me. The second key point is that needs to be financed. And developed countries across the world still have the lowest cost of financing in human history. So we have a capital investment that we can do in under 2 years and a cost of finance that is the lowest it's ever been. Why can't we put those two together and transform our economies quickly?
I absolutely love that, and that's a great section in the book. So there's many good sections in the book where you address really some shaking topics that we need to really grasp and think about. Why aren't we doing them? It's not that's existed for a while. We've had those great interest rates for quite some time now, and over the years it's gone up and down, obviously, but why aren't we doing it? Why aren't we doing it? And I think there's lobbyists and interests and other things to hold on to that business as usual model or onto that high carbon scenario until every last drop is out. There's a great statistics, 850 gigatons of carbon if we continue on our path. We're already at 500 something gigatons, and this is from the IPCC report that just came out, that's already pushing us at our limit at 500 gigatons. Why would we want to continue with this business as usual high carbon scenario to go to 850? Because the consequences are so much worse when we could, in 12 to 18 months, and I actually think that if we have that cooperation and that rally and get out of the incremental growth, we can see it done in a lot less time, probably 6 to 8 months, on some major products that would change the outlook for millions to billions of people around the world. And just take the fuel away from the fire of what's going on in the Ukraine, what's going on elsewhere in the world, where we're really living some of these bad models. So I love that. Is there anything last that you would like to add, Corinne? Because I heard you and saw you also put it in the caveat. You have kind of a foodie. You're a foodie at your core in some respects. You always talk about food and that. And I'm a big foodie, so I'm big on global food systems reformation. And I really think that is one of the biggest levers. In your book, you also talk about the drawdown. Paul Hawken is probably one of the few people in our world that says, what's the quickest, best, most effective ways to draw down global warming? And then he gives the list of action, right? And so that's what you're doing as well. There are things out there. We just need to do them. If you ask most people that question, they're like, I don't know, change our light bulbs, you know? And it's not that. It's the really global food systems reformation, empowering women and girls, and then rethinking refrigeration, and then renewable transition, and all the things that you're talking about, shifting those policies and those models that we're working on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, nothing to add. Food systems is incredibly important. It's also one of the harder pockets of change. It's not as simple as, you know, this 70% delivered through electrification. There are obviously parts of the food systems we can deliver through electrification, but the majority of those emissions are rice paddies, cows, or where they are through the farming infrastructure. It's incredibly fragmented, so it's much harder to actually to reach, you know, those smallhold farmers, say, you know. So it takes... This is where systems change and more ingenuity is needed. In some ways, our book is actually about the low-hanging fruit. Our book is about, we got 10 years to halve emissions. Actually, there's a big chunk of emissions we have the technology. We actually know the social change, institutional change, and legislative change needed to do it. So let's do it. There's absolutely no excuse to not do it. Big parts of food systems is harder. It's not the low-hanging fruit. It's incredibly important. And the way we thought about the book was like, let's make this happen, and then we can focus on these harder problems. We can focus on cement, where we don't yet have... We kind of have some of the solutions, but not all of them. Let's focus on diets, for example, and agriculture, which reach well beyond emissions, deep into kind of biodiversity issues. Yeah, very passionate about the topic, but I would say it's not something we necessarily present solutions to.
But make the green option cheaper.
Yeah, there might be some learnings from the book, but let's say maybe that's the next book.
That's okay. We need tons of books. We need tons of that learning with actionable takeaways. If there was one message that each of you could depart to my listeners as a sustainable takeaway that has the true power to change their life, what would it be, even if it's two different messages?
We always like to come back to first principles about human behavior. And one of the most important principles about human behavior is that we're all sheep. And we talk about this in the book. Most people are sheep. We're massively influenced by what our friends and family and colleagues and folks around us think and do. And one of the easiest and most powerful things you can do is just to talk about these topics, just to talk about them. You know, down the pub, or, you know, the work canteen, or it makes it something that's socially normalized to care about and be engaged in. So I think that's a very small action which has disproportionate impacts.
Become an activist. If you're not one already, you probably are.
If you're listening to this podcast, you probably are.
We can all become activists, and you have more power than you can possibly think.
What have you experienced or learned in your professional journey so far that you would have loved to know from the beginning, from the start?
You know, I'm actually a believer in making mistakes. So, I don't see things like that, you know. I mean, there's definitely things about younger Lonergan that I would now go back and change. Probably, you can always listen more to other people. I think that is a golden rule in life. There is, and often the person that needs to be listened to the most isn't saying anything, and they're over there in the corner, and you need to go over and ask them what they got to say.
Yeah, and sort of linked to that, one of the most impactful and powerful things you can do is create mutual understanding. And that's hard and takes will and commitment. And it comes up a lot in this topic where, over years, I've worked with organizations where there's some folks flying the sustainability flag and they're trying to get a consensus. The rest of the leadership don't really get it. But really just continually having patience and coming at it from different angles and trying to understand where their concerns are, what they're worried about, what motivates them, and then finding what's that bridge between your agenda and their agenda. That's when the change is then unlocked.
Eric, Corinne, thank you so much for letting us all inside of your ideas. It's been a sheer pleasure. We could talk for hours. I have thousands more questions. Everybody go out, supercharge me, get this book, read it. You won't be disappointed. And then also, we'll put the links in the show note description to your websites and blogs and where people can kind of join in and follow your progress and also get little helps and actionable items that they can take forward. That's all I have for you, and I really thank you for your time. It's been a sheer pleasure.
Likewise.
Likewise, really, really enjoyed it and hope to see you in London sometime.
Thank you very much. You guys have a wonderful day.